It's my pleasure to welcome to Many Rivers Books and TV for the first time Beth Weingarner, author of The Columbine Effect, the subject of tonight's talk, as well as this excellently well-selling book, Sacred Sodoma. I think your first book, if I'm not mistaken, is that correct?
It was.
Back from the 1990s, which you don't look as if you could have authored a book back in the 1990s. And yet here you are, and here is the book, and it is a compilation of sacred sites here in Sonoma County, much beloved. Beth Weingarner is an author, obviously, journalist, poet, blogger, and mother. Her journalism has appeared in numerous publications, including The New Yorker, Wired, Mother Jones, USA Today, and the San Francisco Examiner. And in addition to Sacred Sonoma and The Columbine Effect, she has authored also Beloved, Read the Music, Essays on Sound. We are delighted to welcome her here tonight to speak about The Columbine Effect. Welcome, Beth Weingarner.
Thank you. I wanted to introduce the book a little bit more, particularly in light of the fact that we've had a couple of youth violence incidents in the news in recent weeks. I wrote this in part because, as a journalist, I was tired of seeing fellow reporters leap to the wrong conclusions when kids do something violent. And moreover, I was interested in showing why those were the wrong conclusions and the harm that it does to kids who play violent video games or listen to heavy metal or engage in any of these activities that now many people believe make you kill somebody. Most of the time, people who are into these things are totally harmless. They're getting something good out of it. And I wanted to help people understand that they were looking in the wrong places. So with that, I thought I would read a little bit from the chapter on paganism, given where we are. So I'm going to read for a little bit, and then if you guys want to ask questions or anything, we can do that. On December 9th, 2007, Matthew Murray brought guns to the Youth with a Mission Training Center and the New Life Church in Colorado. He killed two people before being wounded by a security guard and then taking his own life. In online postings before the attack, Murray allegedly wrote, "You Christians brought this on yourselves. All I want to do is kill and injure as many of you as I can, especially Christians who are to blame for most of the problems in the world." He went on, "All I found in Christianity was hate, abuse, hypocrisy, and lies. I'm going out to make a stand for all the weak and defenseless. This is for all the young people who are still caught in the nightmare of Christianity, for all those people who've been abused and mistreated and taken advantage of." Murray was homeschooled in a heavily Christian household and had trained for a while at the Youth with a Mission Church before being expelled, according to news articles. After his expulsion, he descended into anti-Christian sentiment, ending with the shootings. If these online postings were indeed from Murray, it's clear that he was enraged and felt he had found the appropriate targets in the New Life Church and the Youth with a Mission Training Center. In the news coverage that followed, reporters played up Murray's involvement in the Ad Astra Oasis. The AAO is an offshoot of the Ordo Templi Orientis, once led by famed occultist Aleister Crowley. A minister who runs the Good Fight website received an email that he believed was from Murray, claiming that the shooter had studied Crowley's teachings as well as the Kabbalah. However, Murray had also been asked to leave the AAO because group leaders felt he wasn't fitting in, so it's not clear how the group could be associated with his actions. It's even less clear what was going on with Murray psychologically. His ouster from both the Youth with a Mission Center and the AAO suggests that there was something about him that didn't gel with either organization. It's unlikely that those expulsions on their own drove him to kill. Plenty of people suffer setbacks without resorting to homicide. It's more likely that his emotional instability is what led leaders in both religious groups to ask him to leave. It's also likely that those expulsions further cracked his mental state. Instead, at least one news article focused on Murray's occult interests as a potential motive for the attack. It cited Crowley's reputation as the most evil man in the world and called Murray a follower. The article played up Crowley's occult escapades and mentioned one of Crowley's compatriots reportedly dying from drinking the blood of a cat during a ceremonial episode. It even suggested that Crowley inspired modern Satanism, but Murray wasn't a Satanist, and neither was Crowley. If this was your only source of information about Murray's rampage, you would be left with the impression that his occult interests sparked his violent actions. You might also believe that occultists, and specifically Satanists, are more prone to murder. In the wake of violence, we long to understand why someone would do such a thing, especially when the killer has died and cannot speak for himself. Journalists attempt to explain the attack in a way that draws the reader in, even if that explanation isn't well informed. However, because occult faiths do not by themselves sanction or encourage violence, the explanation is a dangerous one. It was unlikely that his occult interests drove him to kill, so it's irrelevant for reporters to mention these interests in their articles. This kind of journalism works in part because Americans love a good scare. We seek it in our fiction, video games, horror movies and mystery novels, and in our nonfiction, from true crime books to the nightly news. Average Americans know very little about paganism, Satanism, or divination, so it's easy to scare them with what they don't understand. Some teens who explore these things are hoping it will scare their parents. Since the unknown is feared and therefore the occult is feared, there is a tendency for us to give power to these things that we fear and make them appear even when they are not relevant, said Margot Adler, author of Drawing Down the Moon. We have terror about the occult, so if there is the slightest possibility that there is an occult connection, even if it is just someone who is dressing goth or wearing black or even a trench coat, or heaven forbid using a pentagram, suddenly all sorts of ideas are collected around the crime or incident. The media is at least partly responsible for playing up these fears, according to Adler. Journalists tend to misrepresent occult groups in two different ways. In one approach, they are portrayed as evil, frightening, criminal, and immoral, what Adler calls the exorcist Rosemary's Baby view. It is nourished by the media because it sells, and encourages a fear of the unknown that blunts most people's curiosity and adventurousness, she wrote in Drawing Down the Moon. In the other approach, occultists are painted as trivial, escapist, anti-intellectual, anti-political, narcissistic, amoral, and decadent. Neither one is true. In fact, Adler argues that if the pagan and occult movements were recognized as the intellectual and artistic cultures they are, academics would jump at the chance to study them. Cultural fears of pagan and occult practices are long-standing, and they haven't died down with the advent of more and better information or broader cultural acceptance of pagans. When audiences began devouring the Harry Potter books and films, many feared that young readers, engrossed by the wizard's coming-of-age story, would want to become wizards and magicians themselves. However, once the tale had been out for several years, and it was clear that kids' souls were not being threatened by the popular story, some religious leaders had a change of heart. In its review of the final film in the series, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows 2, the Vatican newspaper reported, "Evil is never presented as fascinating or attractive in the saga, but the values of friendship and sacrifice are highlighted." Another critic noted, "The saga champions values that Christians and non-Christians share." However, after the worries about Harry Potter died down, fears about the popular Hunger Games book took over. The series was number 3 on the list of the most challenged books according to the American Library Association, in part because they were considered occult and satanic, possibly for their suggestion of child sacrifice, which is neither occult nor satanic. Even the internet itself, with its wealth of information about every belief and practice under the sun, is distrusted by some religious conservatives, who claim that using the internet makes teens more vulnerable to demonic influences, including possession. It's worth noting that some of the leaders who have suggested this, Catholic Father Gary Thomas, for example, are exorcists whose life work is helping people get rid of possession. When you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Many pagan teens that I interviewed for this book were frustrated by the ideas others have about their beliefs. One, a 19-year-old from Northern California who became interested in the occult when he was 10, said lots of people think that the occult is evil or a passing rebellious interest that the teen will outgrow. Others think occultists are flaky hippies who just want peace and love, he said. Instead, most of them are normal people. Many don't just fear the occult itself. They're also afraid of learning anything about it, according to a Georgian whose occult interest sparked at 10. The majority of society has literally no education regarding that subject matter and is furthermore conditioned to fear it. Not just fear the path itself, but fear the education about that path. A lot of people are afraid to even know, as if that will somehow taint them. These fears, combined with misunderstanding, can build walls between parents and teens. A child may have stumbled onto a spirituality that feels right, or a set of tools that are helping him or her build self-confidence. But fear may lead parents or others to disparage their discovery. Knowing more about these beliefs and where the fears come from can help. Murray's story is not the first time the public has been frightened into believing that pagans are dangerous. During the Middle Ages and later the Salem witch trials, women and some men were persecuted, tortured, and killed for supposedly practicing witchcraft. They were blamed for all kinds of problems, from sour milk to bad weather, and in each case, a small group of influential people managed to sell the idea that their neighbors either possessed supernatural powers, were under the thrall of the devil, or both. And once the public bought the story, they urged torture and public execution of the accused. One author, Brian Levac, estimated that as many as 60,000 people died during the witch hunts of the 14th through 17th centuries. Author and professor Richard Offshey knows these kinds of panics well. In such situations, the public becomes brainwashed by people who circulate false ideas. This creates a kind of temporary hysteria, according to Offshey, who spent much of the 1980s debunking claims of satanic ritual abuse. In many of these cases, the supposed victims were children. Under the guidance of psychologists or similar professionals, these kids revealed stories of molestation, violent ceremonies, pregnancies, stolen babies, and ritualistic murders, ideas which Offshey says were introduced by the very therapists attempting to help. No evidence of these claims was ever produced, but the stories spread nonetheless. By the end of the decade, as more experts revealed the lack of foundation for satanic ritual abuse, media coverage and hysteria died down. However, the public was left with the picture of Satanists as child-abusing monsters. The satanic panic of the 1980s may have been a revolt against the popular neo-pagan movement born in the 1960s, according to Christopher Moorman. A culture of conservative Christianity thus responded in an extreme way, he wrote in his article, Devil Music and the Great Beast. It has been suggested that a declining social system, combined with a growing sense of helplessness, and a lack of faith in big government, provoked the need for a scapegoat of some kind. America found another bogeyman in Ozzy Osbourne. The heavy metal singer and former Black Sabbath frontman's musical career took off in the late 70s and early 80s. Like Crowley, Osbourne courted a reputation for evil. He notoriously bit the head off of a dove during one event and bit the head off of a bat during another. In the 2000s, Osbourne starred in his own reality TV show with his wife and children, revealing himself to be an average, if eccentric, family man. Through a brief biological sketch, it becomes obvious that Ozzy Osbourne is far from a worshiper of the Dark Lord, but simply a talented iconoclast with a flair for creative controversy and thus publicity, Moorman wrote. While neither Osbourne nor Crowley worship the devil, their anti-authoritarianism, combined with such vices as drugs and women, made them both suitable straw men against whom conservative moralists might rail. Anytime occult trappings appear at a crime scene, reporters play up that angle. Almost every day, news articles claim paganism, the occult, or specifically Satanism is associated with some criminal act. In some cases, Satanism is no more than a headline, literally. In December 2007, the Associated Press ran an article on Robert Hawkins, the gunman who killed 8 people at the Westroads Mall in Omaha, Nebraska. It sported the headline, "Mall Gunman Was Satanic, Suicidal," but failed to mention Satanism anywhere in the story. Putting Satanism in the headline is a good way to get readers' attention, even if it isn't relevant. If the press spun these claims about any other ethnic or religious group, it would constitute defamation or even profiling. Misinformation about occult groups is so widespread and so deeply entrenched in our culture that it is accepted as fact. Unfortunately, this can lead to long jail sentences for those who wind up on the wrong end of the mistake. That's what happened to the West Memphis Three. In 1993, Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miss Kelly were sentenced to life in prison, and Damian Eccles to death row for the murders of three young children. There was very little evidence against them. The story of their trial has been told in several documentaries, including Paradise Lost, The Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills, which Emily Edwards covers in her book, Metaphysical Media, The Occult Experience in Popular Culture. The documentary suggests that there is a modern willingness to condemn witches and that a jury in the 1990s might be as susceptible to a witch craze as one in the 1590s. One of the accused teens, Damian Eccles, wears his hair dyed black, admits that he practices the Wicca religion, and has an interest in heavy metal music. Damian's interest in the occult becomes a central element in his trial. Although the teen explains that Wicca is a religion, the practices a close involvement with nature and teaches people to harm no one because evil you do will come back to you, the prosecutors question the benign nature of his beliefs. They exhibit books on satanic witchcraft belonging to the teen and a piece of paper on which he had written the name Aleister Crowley as evidence of Damien's satanic orientation. Later, DNA technology revealed that Eccles, along with co-defendants Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miss Kelly, were not involved with the killings. After spending nearly half their lives in Arkansas prison, the men were released in 2011. They entered Alford pleas, which allowed them to assert their innocence while acknowledging that there was enough evidence to convict them. Eccles has called West Memphis a second Salem. Along with the press, the police are a major source of information about the occult. There are a number of so-called occult experts working around the country, many of them ex-police officers, who have become fascinated with the topic and who provide the police with seminars and other training. Unfortunately, at best, these experts have an outsider's view of pagan, occult, Satanist, or diaspora beliefs and practices, and at worst, their information is so wrong that it will wind up getting any innocent people into trouble. They say they want to inform the police and assist them in telling the difference between peaceful spiritual practices and real wrongdoing, but when their information is confused and sensationalistic, it tends to have the opposite effect. For example, the late Don Reimer, one of the best-known occult experts in the field, would teach officers the signs the teens are dabbling in the occult. These were included attempted suicide, bizarre cruelty, and running away, or symptoms of occult ritual abuse, harming family pets, preoccupation with death, or discussion of participation in religious ceremonies. Most of these are actually signs that the teen needs a psychiatric evaluation, and the last example is too vague to be meaningful. Much of Reimer's presentation is a mishmash of different faiths and practices, with made-up demon revel holidays listed on the same calendar with the most significant Wiccan holidays. There's a mostly factual but brief section on Wicca, followed by pages of mostly what he calls supposedly demonic song lyrics. It's no wonder the police are confused about the relationship between crime and the occult. In Pursuit of Satan, the Police and the Occult, Hicks demonstrated the police world's preoccupation with Satanism, satanic crime, and occult and cult crime. He described numerous cases in which officers' misreading of a crime scene leads them to believe that there is an occult motive. Police learn much of what they know about cults and the occult through these seminars, he confirms, but the true occult experts are not ones providing that information. Some conservative fundamentalist Christian views drive the cult crime model insofar as cult officers frequently communicate with fundamentalist concepts at seminars. Cult officers employ fundamentalist rhetoric, distribute literature that emanates from fundamentalist authorities, and sometimes offer bibliographies giving many fundamentalist publications. In other words, groups with a strong interest in maligning the occult are putting in charge of teaching the police how to understand it. Meanwhile, officers are warned against studying the subject directly. One law enforcement guide, an otherwise valuable exposé on con games and swindles, addresses Satanism as perhaps the biggest con of all, and advises officers, continue your education in this area by reading as widely as possible on the subject. But note, intense study of the resource materials and books by occult sources is hazardous. Preferred is studying overviews and synopses by credible authors who have studied the occult traditions. The unknown realm of the occult beckons with many lures. Study and or experimentation are to be avoided. There are safer ways to test for poisonous chemicals than by tasting them, he quoted. As a result, many officers who became occult experts don't actually know that much about the subject, Hicks says. It's how you wind up with the Massachusetts police, for example, teaching that occultists and Satanists practice animal and human sacrifice, despite how rare that actually is. Police sometimes meet violent criminals who do have a deep interest in paganism or the occult. These interactions may be officers' only contact with non-Christians, leading them to believe that the criminals are typical pagans, according to Hicks. While some journalists get bad information from the police, police also learn about occult crime by reading the newspapers, he said. After a rash of articles linking teen suicide to the occult, an article in the Law Enforcement News blamed one teen's crime spree on some satanic and occult books found underneath his bed. A 14-year-old Jefferson Township, New Jersey boy kills his mother with a Boy Scout knife, sets the family home on fire, and commits suicide in the neighbor's backyard. Investigators find books on the occult and Satan worship in the boy's room. Did the boy have a collection of spiders? A stack of pornographic literature under his bed? A girlfriend who just jilted him? Newspaper accounts never mention other possible explanations, since only those touched by a nameless, faceless evil will explain why good boys go bad, he wrote. After being barraged by enough articles linking occultism to violence, it's no wonder parents come to the conclusion, the same conclusion, when tragedy strikes. In another case, reported in Denver Magazine, a mother described the suicide of her 16-year-old son. From what we can tell, he evidently must have performed some kind of satanic death ritual. He was barefoot, and we found symbols drawn on the ground. In his suicide note, he says, "It is time for me to meet my lofty maker. I have now started the lonesome journey to the bowels of the earth. I travel that twisted road that winds its way down to the forsaken pit. My destination will be the foot of the throne where I kneel and greet my father." She said that her son listened to heavy metal music, collected knives, played Dungeons and Dragons, and owned several occult books, all of which she only discovered after his death. "At first we blamed ourselves," she told the magazine. "Then we started learning about similar deaths and seeing the pattern. Slowly we realized we weren't responsible." The boy's parents may not have been responsible for his suicide, but why did they know so little about their son's interests, hobbies, and apparently deteriorating mental state? By placing blame on the wrong things, we come no closer to understanding the real reasons why a few teenagers kill themselves and others. Many adults who long to understand these acts wind up looking in the wrong places. News outlets and law enforcement aren't helping. And there aren't enough sources of honest information for people who are looking for real, honest answers. Let's see. I'm going to read for a few minutes more and then take a break. Abel Gomez was 13 when he discovered paganism. He looked into a number of disciplines, including witchcraft, Hinduism, Buddhism, Kabbalah, shamanism, and ceremonial magic, before he joined the Reclaiming Collective, a Wiccan group. "I wanted something fresh, something that spoke to my deep yearning for connection to mystery and the unseen world," he said. All of these traditions spoke to the same fundamental yearning for a deeper sense of connection. He chose Wicca because it's based in nature and for its connections with the ancient mythic gods. He chose Reclaiming because it provides a community framework for his spirituality, he said. He was looking for a path that helped him better understand the world around him. At a time of questioning and stripping away of idealizations in search of deeper truths, teens seek spirituality that is both moving and relevant, he said. Amid war, environmental destruction, and poverty, teens ask how spirituality can help create a better world and a more complete, integrated people. in pursuit of deeper truths, greater autonomy, and connection with the natural world, many modern teens are exploring esoteric and earth-based spiritual paths. When Gomez joined Reclaiming as a teen, he realized its powerful combination of witchcraft, community, and political activism was powerful, he said. And he began attending regular rituals and other events. Something struck a chord with me. I loved the simplicity and profundity of group of people gathered together to sing, honor the old gods, make magic, and celebrate the turning of the earth. Through Reclaiming, Gomez felt transformed. It has given me a greater sense of connection to the gods, to the world around me, and to my own heart's yearning. This sense of connection has been the motivation to become a vegan, volunteer in my community, and work toward environmental sustainability, and get involved with social justice movements, he said. There are a mind-boggling number of alternative spiritualities out there, and teens, like adults, check out any or all of them in the hope of finding something that's right for them. Nationally, it's tough to find good statistics on just how many teens are exploring or following pagan beliefs. For one thing, data can be useful or not depending on how the people describe themselves in surveys. Many Americans believe that the occult is sinister, amusing, or neurotic, and they think occultists are weird, disturbed, or dangerous. But these same people might believe in something considered occult, such as ghosts. If you ask them whether they're pagans or occultists, they would say no, but their beliefs might tell another story. My sense, based on research with adults and teen pagans, is that the number of adolescents who check out paganism is relatively small, less than 10% of the population. At the same, it's not uncommon for youth to try it. Some read a few books, attempt some spells, and then move on. Others develop a deep connection to a spiritual practice that stays with them for years. Many adolescents, like many adults, long to make sense of their existence. They want to know why they're here, why the world is often such a confusing place, and whether they have some spiritual purpose. At the same time, adolescents are all about breaking away from the patterns of childhood and striking out on their own. Many teens are exploring their identity in a way that they haven't before and beginning to discover who they'll become as adults. It's also a time of intense and emotional and hormonal upheaval. That can make teens feel as though the need for a spiritual path is urgent. As they cast aside the traditions of their parents, they may abandon the church they grew up with. In Unchristian, Kinnaman and Lyons discovered a number of reasons why teens break away from the church. Some have lost respect for Christianity because they find it anti-homosexual, judgmental, or hypocritical. Other teens felt that many Christians were out of touch with reality and too focused on converting people. While Kinnaman and Lyons' research showed that many teens tried Christianity on for size, a good chunk of them didn't stick with it because of their disillusionment. Christians have become famous for what we oppose rather than what we are for, they said. We are known for having an us versus them mentality. Outsiders feel minimized, or worse, demonized by those who love Jesus. A huge chunk of the new generation has concluded that they want nothing to do with us. At the same time, they found that youths are hungry for new experiences and new sources of motivation, particularly ones that allow them to try things for themselves without experts or talking heads getting in the way. They weren't the only ones who learned that teenagers mistrusted the Christian church. Jeffrey Jensen Arnett interviewed hundreds of heavy metal fans in the 90s and shared his findings in Metalhead's Heavy Metal Music and Adolescent Alienation. There are some teens who are contemptuous of religion, who cite the hypocrisy of televangelists and the acquisitiveness of organized religion as evidence that all religion is a sham, but most are indifferent to it. It does not move them. It adds to their alienation for what it fails to provide for them. It does not give them comfort, reassurance, a stable social network outside the family, a ready source of meaning, the way it has in virtually every other society, historically and cross-culturally, he wrote. Many of the teens and former teens I interviewed for this book gave up on the church and struck out in search of something more comfortable for a variety of reasons. I had some significant issues with mainstream religion, said an Atlanta, Georgia resident who began exploring the occult at age 16. I couldn't deal with the falseness and the hypocrisy between what was preached and what the priests actually did in their day-to-day lives. I became disillusioned with Catholicism because it tended to be very hypocritical. I became an atheist due to my small-town upbringing. I didn't know there were any other choices, said a pagan who grew up in the Midwest and discovered the occult at 14. Until Kinnaman and Lyons wrote Unchristian, little was known about teens and their relationship to spirituality. Few people have thought to study teens' religious leanings. According to Charles Shelton, who wrote Adolescent Spirituality, a Pastoral Ministry for High School and College Youth, Shelton, too, found that teens needed religion and religious commitment, but had serious issues with the church. Those who remained Christian developed their own unique bond with Jesus Christ. Teens are driven by personal relationships and the meaning that those relationships give to their own lives, Shelton wrote. As part of those relationships, adolescents engaged in sexual activity to meet a number of needs, including intimacy, belonging, identification, and imitation, and the desire for dominance, submissiveness, passion, and intensity. They were also curious, looking for competence, and hoping to rebel, according to Shelton. All of these needs, desires, and motivations also explain why teens explore and choose the spiritual paths they do. The search for identity during the teen years provides the perfect backdrop for spiritual experimentation, according to Sharon Parks. Teens are just beginning to reflect on the meaning of life, and with that comes a whole avalanche of spiritual questions. To attend to faith is to be concerned with the questions so familiar to those who grieve and to others who suffer meaninglessness. Why should I get out of bed in the morning? What is the purpose of my existence and the existence of others? Does anything really matter? What can I depend on? Are we ultimately alone? What can be trusted as real, and what is my relationship to that? What is the ultimate character of the cosmos in which I dwell? Parks wrote. Younger children in faith often start out by believing that there is a supreme authority. As they become teenagers, they learn that all information, including spiritual information, is relative. That discovery kicks off the search for personal truth, according to Parks. At the same time, teens are struggling with a relatively fragile sense of what she calls inner dependence, one that is vulnerable to disappointment, failure, exclusion, abandonment, emptiness, and hopelessness. Many times they will choose a spiritual path that gives them a hands-on feeling of success, belonging, satisfaction, and optimism. Most pagan and occult paths offer just these kinds of feelings. Does anyone have any questions?
One question I have is the characterization of journalists and their relationship to the occult, or their relationship to sensationalism in a story, doesn't strike me as a modern phenomenon, but that's something that seems to have been present with journalism about as long as it's existed, as far as historic sources I've seen. And American journalism in particular seems to be particularly given by its nature, just trying to give attention to sensationalizing any aspect of a story. And the occult is a juicy one for a strongly Christian society.
It's very much the low-hanging fruit, you know, if you can get that into a story. I'm working on something right now, writing about this Slender Man stabbing that took place over the weekend. I mean, it's not a cult, but it's the same kind of thing. No, these are the 12-year-olds in Milwaukee who stabbed a classmate, saying that they did it in a tribute to this, and it turns out to be a fictional internet character that they had become very interested in. But you know, I mean, I'm a journalist. I get why you would want to write about that. It's juicy. It's interesting. It doesn't happen very often, but neither does a 12-year-old girl stabbing another 12-year-old girl, and you think the focus on that would probably be enough to retain readers.
And plotting it for months. Where are the parents? These girls are going through all this in their minds.
Well, narratives require a simple plot structure, typically, and that kind of story, just like the narratives we have in all all the things in their hyperventilating in the journalism today on various topics. I'll have a very simple cause and effect plot story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting question as to, you know, why we as people eat that up as opposed to looking for a more complex and uncertain mm-hmm. truth.
I think not knowing why somebody would do something makes us very uneasy. Because then it means we have no idea of knowing whether it could happen to us. It's a way, I think, of saying, well, that person was into the Slender Man thing. I don't know anybody who's into that, so I'm probably safe.
Right. Or just the, as you say, the uncertainty is something that we're, I would hazard to say, even biologically conditioned to not like.
Yeah, yeah.
And so journalism plays into that by offering a simple formula.
Mm-hmm.
And the more compelling the simple formula, the more papers you sell or the more hits you get on your internet site now.
True, and most often the information that you get as a reporter when you're at the scene is very different from the bigger picture that you get later on, a year later, 2 years later. That was certainly the case with Columbine, where, you know, 10 years later a book comes out that says, well, these guys were probably a sociopath and a very depressed kid who was following along with them.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have anything to do with Trench Coats, didn't have anything to do with video games. But that was all, a lot of that came from a kid at the scene who just showed up and didn't know the kids and didn't go to the school and just, you know, was kind of clowning around with the press. So it can be very hard to figure out, you know, when you're scrambling to get that story, what information is real and what information is the truth of the situation. But you want to tell a good story.
Well, more importantly, the market insists on a good story in order for
yeah.
there to be a successful transaction.
I have a lot of thoughts about where journalism is going right now. Make me very sad.
Well, I mean, it's, again, I guess the question I have is journalism going anywhere differently than it's ever been? There's a market for thoughtful, considered, deep form analysis, and that appeals to a certain subsection of the potential accessible market, and then there's a larger market that wants a simple package story that has mm-hmm. some sort of juice factor in it.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of the problem with so much of journalism migrating to an online environment, you get your ad sales by the number of people who click on something.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to particularly make your headline something that they're not going to be able to resist. So you get these, you know, you'll never believe what happened next headlines, which just drive me up the wall. But, you know, people, again, they want to know the answer to whatever that question was that's posed by the headline. So they click through, and then they're like, that wasn't that interesting.
But they've clicked through.
Exactly.
I think I've read in the description of his talk or somewhere that he said that violent video games, Grand Theft Auto or whatever, I don't even know which ones are violent, but that the kids were getting valuable mm-hmm. lessons out of those.
Mm-hmm.
What lessons, what value were they getting out of violent videos?
I think it varies a lot from kid to kid, but there's a lot of research that suggests that it helps them reduce anxiety about the world around them if they can sort of, it's a form of role play. A lot of times you pick the character that you're going to play, and you might be wondering what it's like to go off to war in Afghanistan. You don't really want to go off to war in Afghanistan, but if you know people who have and you're sort of trying to make sense of the violence involved in that, then playing a war game might answer that question for you. A lot of other research is showing that kids are doing really well when they play cooperatively with other people. So if there's a game where both of you can act out as, you know, soldiers fighting together, or you're on some space mission where you have to kill all of the aliens who are trying to take over your spaceship or whatever, that builds the social relationship with the people you're working with, teamwork, it teaches you problem solving. A lot of this stuff is extremely fast-paced, so you have to think on your feet really quickly. And the other thing, I don't know if you've played video games, but they are extremely frustrating. But to get anywhere in the game, you have to keep going. So you have to get past your frustration and move on to the next thing. And I don't know about you, but I could actually use more lessons in getting past my frustration when I can't do something. Exactly. So, I mean, those are some of the examples. There's a great woman in Canada, Jane Gackenbach, who's done studies on soldiers who come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. Not post-traumatic stress disorder soldiers, but, you know, those who are kind of on the line. If they play video games, violent video games, they're less likely to have nightmares related to their tour in combat, because they're dealing with it in another way, consciously and subconsciously. So, did that answer your question?
Yeah.
I think you had a question.
I just want to know, what is the reclaiming you were talking about? I've never heard of that. I don't know what it is.
It was started by Starhawk. I don't know if you know who she is. She wrote The Spiral Dance, and you guys probably saw some of her other books.
Earth
Power.
She started it, and correct me if I'm misremembering, as a Wiccan response to nuclear proliferation, partly. They were doing a lot of protests at nuclear sites and things like that. But it turned into a large community, and she's even written books about how challenging it is to run a pagan community, and sort of like developing that sense of working together when everyone has different ideas about how to run
a community. Running a volunteer organization.
So she started it, but there are chapters throughout the Bay Area and I think across the country. And they hold events, particularly in the Bay Area. They have a website. I think it's reclaiming.org.
Yeah, I've never heard of it. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Just a comment that when I first read the title, Columbine Effect, I thought it would talk about the being a role model, a negative role model, because certainly if I watch the news, it seems to be there are more and more shootings at educational setting. Just on the drive here today, there was another shooting in Seattle.
I heard about that.
So I understand that the book is debunking the causation or even the correlation between those topics and violence. On the other hand, do you think these seemingly increasing number of violent events, shootings at schools, does it have a ripple effect that more and more people frustrated or depressed or psychotic think that, okay, I can do that too?
There is the argument that some of the people who committed mass shootings did so because they were obsessed with beating a prior mass shooter. It sounds like Adam Lanza was like that with Columbine. He wanted to do better than Columbine. Or I can't even remember, maybe he even wanted to do better than the guy in Oslo a couple of years ago. But there's a certain group, and I think there are different groups of people who commit these kinds of crimes, but there's a certain group that seems to follow the achievements of the prior perpetrators in almost obsessive detail. And while I don't know if that answers your question, but I don't know if that's necessarily making more people do more acts or whether we're just paying attention to it more.
I saw an interview with Stephen King, and I don't remember how long ago it was. It must have been like 15 or 18 years ago now. There was some guy who did a shooting in junior high school, and one of Stephen King's books was found in his locker.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some kind of connection in the material that he left. And Stephen King withdrew the book from circulation. It's the only book he ever
throughout that he, you can't get it now. You haven't been able to get it for a very long time. And in the interview, they were asking him about that, and he said that he didn't think there was a cause and effect relationship between this kind of media, and he wasn't talking about just books, but he also included like video games and stuff like that. But he did, what he said is that he felt they could act as accelerants to an already disturbed mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he withdrew the book. And I was wondering if you have an observation on that or a comment about that?
You mean about whether such things can act as an accelerant?
Yeah, I mean, do you, what do you think about Stephen King doing that, or
well, I think probably the one person who was going to commit a crime based on that book already did so, and probably pulling it from the market didn't likely prevent anything else from happening. You know, and the same thing happened after Columbine. Marilyn Manson, to whom the boys did not even listen, canceled a tour because he thought it would be insensitive to go on a tour around the country when everyone thought he was responsible, even though he knew that he wasn't. So, I mean, I think from a performer's perspective, there can be that level of sensitivity. You recognize that maybe it's not a direct cause, but it's kinder to withdraw the media for a while. But I think, you know, in each of these different events, the perpetrator is obsessed with something. Video game, the killing spree that happened 2 years ago, internet memes, whatever. But the problem isn't the object of the obsession. I mean, that would be like saying women made Elliot Rodger kill people. You know.
Oh, interesting. Okay, that's interesting.
But what happened was he became so obsessed with this idea that women had wronged him. But it was his own disturbance that was the problem. It's just that his disturbance tried to rationalize itself somewhere.
So if I understand what you're saying, I'm asking a question. I'm not that people who are disturbed or inclined in that direction search for a rationalization for it, and they might latch on to this, and they might latch on to that.
Or they might, it might just happen. I don't know if they search for it.
It's like those websites he was visiting, anti-women eating websites. That would kind of accelerate it.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, because it goes to the accelerant theory that you have today's media environment, particularly where the internet has a much greater potential for someone to gravitate to an extremely limited set of views that reinforce a cycle of ideation, and that dynamic may intensify or increase the probability that a sociopathic condition reaches a more extreme level, and that doesn't mean we should stop that. It's just that it's like,
yeah, shut down the internet, everybody.
it's just an interesting. It's an interesting question, and it's probably a testable hypothesis as to whether there's a greater probability of these kinds of events happening now, just because of the accessibility. Not just the accessibility, but it's more like the accessibility and the ability to sort of exclusively obsess in a way that gives you the appearance of objective validation of your point of view.
You find what you're looking for.
Yes, it's very easy to do that now, which is ironic because the internet provides you with so many different perspectives that you can expose yourself to.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to imagine a similar phenomenon, and it's not like crimes like this and situations like this didn't happen in the 1920s or the 1910s, but the ability for people to deep end in a a kind of an ideational fit that cuts them off from other people. My impression is it's harder. I don't know that for a fact. It's just that I guess that the thesis that I'm pushing for.
Well, and I think we have this idea that mental health issues are something you can just sort of bootstrap your way out of if you know, just take the initiative. And we also have this idea if we see somebody acting a bit funny, that's their business. We don't need to get involved in that. We try to leave each other alone instead of acting as a community.
I was just, all of a sudden when you were talking about pulling the book and accelerants, I was thinking, well, if that was true, you would pull the Bible off the shelf, because the Crusades was like a great way. I mean, that's a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
As you know.
Well, the Bible's a good example of that, where people can read into that book whatever their particular interest is, whether it's positive or negative.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming tonight. Thank you, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
Reading for us. And of course, there's copies of The Columbine Effect and Sacred Stone here on the table. We encourage you to take a look at those on your way out. We also encourage you to contribute to the donation bowl that we observe the Buddhist practice of dana, or generosity. And so we encourage you to contribute to that bowl, which we share with our speaker to further her work and also to help maintain this space for future such events. So thank you for coming to Many Rivers Books and Tea, and have a lovely evening. Come back and join us when you can actually get into the bookshelves at some time when they're not pushed aside on wheels. And thanks again for coming tonight.
Thank you.